No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote.
Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People Their Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show, which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. I'm joined by my co-host, Marilia Duffels, and together we hope our show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to all of us and affect our lives every day. Normally, we would ask you to call in, but we have a special guest today, and so we're pre-recording. And our guest today is none other than Senator Joseph Lieberman. Senator Lieberman was in the United States Senate for 24 years. He was chairman of the powerful Homeland Security and Government Affairs Committee. He was my party's Democratic nominee for vice president in the year 2000, majority leader of the Senate in Connecticut, and a former Connecticut attorney general. And we're so happy to have him with us today. Welcome to our show, Senator Lieberman.
Thank you, Senator Brown. Great to be with you. I love that musical introduction. I never heard that before.
Oh, yes, Sweet Honey in the Rock. It's a great song. And I'm also here with my co-host, Marilia Duffel, so let me introduce her. And first, let me start out with just saying how much we appreciate you in Washington, D.C., Senator. You not only introduce the statehood bill in the United States Senate when you were there, but you were a fierce advocate for the bill. And we very much appreciate that. As you know, probably, we have another iteration of that bill in the United States Senate right now. It's being pushed and was introduced, and our new advocate in the Senate is Senator Carper of Delaware, who said publicly that the reason he's doing it is because you asked him to do it. You left, you asked him to take the lead, and he certainly has. As you know, we have 46 co-sponsors, but we're stuck, Senator. Anyway, is there any chance that we're going to get a Republican on this bill? Do you think that'll happen? It's totally partisan at this point.
There ought to be. I mean, the problem is it's hard to be optimistic about it because we're in such a partisan time generally in our Washington politics. Everything is Democrat, Republican, tribal. Yeah. And so the assumption is, which is a probability but not a certainty, that if D.C., and I don't want to say when D.C., attained statehood, that its two senators would be Democratic. Well, as I've said in testimony on this issue, you could say that's a probability, but honestly, you never know what's going to happen in an election. It was just that election in Virginia. Everybody assumed former Governor Terry McAuliffe was going to win in a state that's been trending Democratic, but lo and behold, for various reasons, the Republican wins. And, so it goes. I mean, who would have guessed that in the last election, 2020, that two Democrats would be elected to the U.S. Senate from Georgia? Everybody just assumed would be Republican. So you can't tell, but it's a partisan time, and too many people are looking at this question of D.C. statehood simply in that partisan, political, parochial way, when really they ought to be looking at it, as the song said, as a question of what's right according to our American values. I mean, we talk a lot about voting rights for the last few years, and it's much in dispute both in Washington and in a lot of the state capitals. But we got hundreds of thousands of people who happen to live in our nation's capital of all places, which is, well, by that I mean the capital of this great democracy, which is built on the right to vote and the impact of the vote on who gets to govern, who gets to lead our country. And they can't vote for members of Congress who can represent with full voting rights in the Congress. I mean, to me, it's just an outrageous anomaly that you can't justify anymore. You can't justify it, in my opinion, ever. But anyway, so that's my opinion, and it's an uphill fight, and yet it's really an important fight worth making. There are a lot of good people on the Republican side in the Senate. It would take real guts for them to break from the party, but I just think to the extent that you and the District of Columbia and those of us who agree with you about statehood, just sort of go and talk with the people, the Republican senators, one by one, if you think there's any chance of getting their support, and just make the case. And there's nothing to lose and a lot to gain.
Well, let me ask you in that regard. I don't want to monopolize your time. I'm going to give Marilee a chance to ask you a question. But you are the co-chair of a thing called No Labels, which I think is just an amazing, amazing thing, organization that's been around, that's trying to get rid of the trying to make a bipartisan consensus in both houses. You have a thing called the Problem Solvers Caucus, with 50 members, 25 Republicans and 25 Democrats, if I read the press release right, in the House. And, you know, I have to commend you for that. And your co-chair is Larry Hogan, who's a very, very well-liked Republican governor of Maryland. And so how's that going? Do you see a future? I see that you put out a statement in support of the infrastructure bill, trying to get bipartisan support on that. What do you think? You think that's we're ever gonna have that happen? That we start making bipartisan consensus again? I mean, we've done it on the infrastructure bill. Can we do it on other things?
Yeah, I mean, thanks for talking about the infrastructure bill, because it should be a basis of giving us some confidence that we can do it again. You know, when I the No Labels was started probably 2010, and I was still in the Senate. I supported it, but I didn't have the time to get really actively involved. When I left the Senate, it seemed to me that one of the things I wanted to continue to do was to work for a return of two-party solutions, bipartisanship in Congress, which is always what you had to have, because rarely in the Senate does one party have 60 votes, and that's the filibuster. So the No Labels was created. The basic point is, forget your label. You're a Democrat, you're a Republican, you're a liberal, you're a conservative, but the important thing is we're all Americans. And we've got to be able to come to the center, not to all become moderates, but to bring our opinions, our ideologies, our party affiliations to the center, meet in the center, and talk about problems civilly with one another, do what has always happened in our history, all the way back to the Constitutional Convention, negotiate, understand you can almost never in a democracy get 100% of what you want on a given bill. But it's a lot better to negotiate and get 50 or 60% than to hold out for 100% and get nothing. And No Labels began by just trying to get Republicans and Democrats in Congress together to talk about the same problems, whatever they were. And so we continue to do that. But we also, frankly, started a separately raise money for Republican and Democratic candidates for Congress who we felt really were centrists, and whatever their party affiliation or ideology, they were going to work for two-party solutions. And that led to the House Problem Solvers Caucus and something in the Senate called the Common Sense Coalition, which ultimately became the Group of 10, which in the bipartisan infrastructure bill brought forth from these two groups became the Group of 20 senators. And when it got into the Senate, President Biden sort of entered the room and negotiated with the Republicans and Democrats in the Senate. And they came up with an agreement, passed the Senate with 69 votes, including Mitch McConnell, went to the House, was held up for a while because the progressives in the House caucus wanted to get a commitment on the other bill, which was their right. But ultimately, there was a separate vote on the bipartisan infrastructure bill. And it was bipartisan, really, in the vote. I mean, six Democrats voted against it. And so if every Republican voted against it, it wouldn't have passed. But 13 Republicans bolted from their party, if you want a little optimism about the possibility of getting Republican Senate support for statehoods. Maybe there's a little bit of encouragement. And it passed, and President Biden signed it in a big ceremony. It's a great accomplishment for Congress and, of course, more important, for the country. So it can happen. I mean, if I can get in a shameless plug, I just wrote a book that was published called The Centrist Solution. And it's my attempt, and the subtitle is How We Made Government Work and Can Make It Work Again. And I describe five or six big cases in which, in my 24 years in the Senate, we solved big problems by working together, and whether it was environmental or national security or homeland security or human or civil rights and budget balance stuff. And I think there's no mystery to it. You just got to, that's what I'm hope the book gives some encouragement to voters who read it, but I hope it also gives a lesson to members of Congress and people in the White House. All you got to do is be willing to sit and talk together and figure out how you can make the system work. I'll just say one final word about it. Being a centrist is not the same thing as being a moderate. And as I write in this book, one of the great centrists that I worked with in my 24 years was Teddy Kennedy. Well, Ted Kennedy was obviously a liberal Democrat, and a real believing, passionate liberal Democrat. But when Teddy wanted to get something done, wow, he came to the center, met with the Republican opposition or leaders on his committee and in the Senate, and negotiated, just like I said. And he got some enormous things done, Children's Health Insurance Program, Americans with Disabilities Act, health care reform, education reform. What I'm saying is you don't have to be a moderate to be a centrist. You just have to want to get something done in the time in which you're lucky enough to serve the people in Congress.
Well, you know, now that you brought up his name, I also have to mention he introduced the statehood bill, and he was famous for having a personal relationship with Bob Dole. And, you know, I don't see any of that going on in the Senate anymore. But let me tell you, the thing that intrigues me most about No Labels is the name of the organization, No Labels, because I think that's unfortunately where we've gone. You know, you tell me you're a Republican, I know all about you. You tell me I tell you I'm a liberal, you know all about me. So the labels are really important. Really, I don't want to monopolize the time.
Great. They become too important. Michael, it's a great point. You got to get away from that, because most people are not 100% liberal or 100% conservative or Democrat. They vote for the person, they vote for the idea, support the idea. But that's all changing now, even among the people, not just the politicians. And that's really dividing our country when we really can't afford it.
Yeah, absolutely. Marilia, do you have a question for the senator?
Well, What I was going to say is exactly what you brought up, which is no labels. And I kind of stumbled upon it back in 2011 when I went into a building on Wisconsin Avenue and saw the office and was intrigued by the name. And I went in and asked them about it. And it struck me that the Tea Party, which I believe had started about a year before, unfortunately got a lot more play than No Labels. I thought No Labels was fantastic and exactly what we need. And that was, as you know, we know 10 years ago. Why do you think the Tea Party got so much purchase? They got so much more media coverage. I mean, they were basically in the news all the time. And why did No Labels, when that is exactly what should have happened? No Labels represented things like, you know, the likes of a Jack Kemp working with a Democrat like Tony Hall from Ohio, both working together on poverty issues. And now you have Jim Grassley just, you know, running away from what makes sense just because he's bowing to the cult of Trump.
Yeah, well, I must say, I love that story of you walking into the building where No Labels was.
Yeah.
And your question is a really significant one, and it says a lot about where we are. And frankly, it says in our politics in America, and it says a lot about the negative influence of the media, unfortunately, because they highlight controversy. They highlight people who are yelling at each other. Most significantly, President Trump, when he was in, he was in the ultimate of that. But every day, I'll tell you an interesting story about the book I just wrote, The Central Solution. Somebody said to me, "You know, you're not going to get a major publisher to publish this because they believe that the money is in left or right books." And particularly books that are nasty towards somebody or the other party. Centrism, this person doesn't sell. Well, I got a good publisher called Diversion to publish it, but that's really interesting. You look at the bestseller list of some of the newspapers, and really it's the and now it's often the personalities on the media, like the Fox network personality when they write a book. Or CNN, on the other hand, or even MSNBC, they tend to sell more copies immediately than others. And they, you know, and I grew up in a time, it was before cable, so I'm getting on in years, where we had broadcast news every night. And, you know, people like Walter Cronkite, Chet Huntley, people like that. Honestly, I couldn't have guessed whether any of them were Democrats or Republicans, liberals or conservatives. Exactly. Basically, they just ordered the news, and that was pretty good for the country.
So how do we unite people around this? You know, one of our previous guests, Dan Rather, has written a book called What Unites Us. You know, a similar, I don't know how well it's doing, but a similar idea that we do have core values as Americans, don't we, Senator, that we all love our children. We love our country. We, you know, aren't there core values?
There are core values. You might have some disagreement from people, but you're right. I'll say this on paper, the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence express our founding values, which are still core values, and that sentence in the Declaration of the self-evident truth that we're all created equal by our Creator and endowed by the Creator with the rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Now, our history is really in the best light an attempt to continue to realize that core value, because it obviously wasn't realized at the beginning. I mean, people of color just were not counted equally in the terrible compromise of the Constitutional Convention. As you know, five African Americans were counted as three people per population, but of course they couldn't vote. population representation. Women had no rights. And so really over our history, we have extended and applied those values. But beyond that, there is an ethic in our country that people feed into. People, as you said, they care about their kids. They want a better, safer future for the kids than they've had for themselves. And they're doubting that now. A number that I follow in the polls, which really concerns me, is that you ask people, is the country headed in the right direction or wrong? And I had a feeling that Trump could have won and might win in 2016, even though I was a strong supporter of Hillary Clinton, because almost two-thirds of the people kept saying the country's headed in the wrong direction. So it seemed ripe for a change. And then again in 2020, again they said wrong direction. And I thought, you know, Joe Biden has a chance here, and of course he won. But unfortunately, the numbers were better at the outset of the Biden administration. Now, once again, it's about two-thirds, almost 70% of the country saying the country's headed in the wrong direction. And we've really got to get back to our core values, as you described them, and as the people really generally live them in their communities, in their neighborhoods, in their churches, in their synagogues and mosques, and wherever they are around the country. And the government has to reflect that instead of spending all its time just standing on a Republican side of a fence and a Democratic side and throwing verbal rocks at each other all the time. So I've got time maybe for one more question. I apologize. But it's been a great discussion. And, I just look for the day when Washington has not a shadow senator, but a senator.
So, yeah, amen.
Amen to that. And I'm sorry, Marilia, I have to ask this question.
No, please, by all means.
I was in Los Angeles at the convention when you accepted our party's nomination. I've been at every convention for the past 40 years. When you accepted our party's convention, our party's nomination for vice president, you were in one of the closest elections in American history. You and Vice President Gore lost by 5 electoral votes. We all remember the hanging chads and all the nonsense that went around with that. But when it was over, and the challenges had been made, you and Vice President Gore accepted the results of the election. How damaging is it that the Republicans, a core group of Republicans, has refused to stand up and say, yes, Joe Biden is our president, yes, the election was fair? Does that damage our democracy so much?
Oh, it's terribly damaging, because the legitimacy of the vote, which determines who holds power, is a centerpiece of our system of government. And if after the votes are counted and you have your chance to go to court, which is where problems are resolved in this rule of law country of ours, and the courts basically say no. I mean, and I'll go back to 2000. Al Gore and I felt that the Supreme Court decision, U.S. Supreme Court in Bush v. Gore, was a terrible and unfair decision, really without precedent. But and I give Al Gore the credit here. We talked about it late that night when the decision came out. And there was some in the campaign arguing that we go back to the Florida Supreme Court, which the U.S. Supreme Court seemed to allow. But Al said, and I must say I wasn't as clear as he was. I sort of said, well, maybe we should try it. What do we got to lose? There's a lot on the line here. And he said, let's think about it. He called me back about an hour later. It was after midnight. And he said, I decided we've got to end it, Joe. He said, you know, we're getting close to the day on which the new president is supposed to be inaugurated. And if we go back to Florida, it won't be decided until then. There'll be a constitutional a problem about who's in control of the government. So President Trump had his right. He and his followers filed 50 lawsuits decided by judges appointed by various presidents' parties. And they lost them all, and yet he wouldn't accept it. And that led to the nightmarish events of January 6th, which nobody ever imagined. I certainly didn't. We would ever see in our country, and it's way as bad as the Civil War, and really fought for something that is much, to put it mildly, much less worthy than the battle for the Civil War, which is about slavery. And in fact, President, I offer this final opinion. So what the President Trump and his followers have done, I think, is very hurtful to our system. But I now think that the fact that they continue to complain, and it becomes a centerpiece of what they're doing about the that Joe Biden is a illegitimate president, is really reducing support for them and for President Trump if he decides to run again. So they've hurt democracy. They've hurt our system. But I think an increasing number of Americans are feeling, come on. I mean, this America is always in our life. Life is about today and tomorrow, not about yesterday. And really, it's time for them to move on. And as long as they cling to that stale argument, I think it's going to hurt them now more than it hurts the country. Hey, listen, it's great. Been great to talk to both of you. And keep up the fight. Tom Carper is a great advocate. He was right in what he said. I believe so much in D.C. statehood. Incidentally, Eleanor Holmes Norton and I went to law school together.
I know.
It was like a reunion, you know, when we got from the beginning to work on all that together and on the D.C. statehood. And Tom's a believer, and he's a very methodical worker. So he and I just felt this is something I really believe in. I want to make an appeal to Tom because he was about at that point to become the senior Democrat on the Homeland Security Government Affairs Committee, which has jurisdiction over D.C. and statehood. And God bless him. He had been for it all along. And he said, you know, I'll take the baton. I'll take the torch. And he has. And just don't give up, because this is, you know, justice. Dr. King said it, the arc of the moral universe bends slowly, but it bends toward justice. And we'll get there, and we have a right and an obligation to do all we can to bend that arc more rapidly than it might naturally move. Anyway, great to talk to you both. Just have
thank you.
Great day. Thank you.
And we'll talk to you again sometime soon.
Okay, thank you, Senator Lieberman. Thanks so much for being with us. And now let me apologize to my co-host, really, for monopolizing the time, but that's what happens when you have one of your heroes on the show. You know,
I'm sorry, Mike.
And you know what? Mm-hmm. I'm glad that we have some, you and I have some time to talk, because you know, this I think will be our inaugural show on WEAC Radio, and I want our listeners to know something about you. You know, I think you're a phenomenal person. We've been friends for years. Your background is amazing. The idea of the show when we started it was to get people that come from different perspectives. And much like the idea behind No Labels, try to show that there's just as much that unites us as separates us. And, you know, your background's different than mine in the sense that we both have a political background, but you were appointed by Republican presidents to do things. I've always been a Democrat. You obviously have a different perspective as a woman. So it's really great to have you on the show and have you share in this experience. It's not only because it's great for me personally, because I know and care about you and we've known each other for years, but also because I think you bring so much to the table, so much to the discussion, and I'm just so happy that we continue to do this, and we're doing it with a woman who's an independent and a guy that's a Democrat. And we hope, much like Maria and I, we will come to consensus on many things, and I think we will. you know, we both love our country and love our families, and we do have the same core values, do we not?
Well put, absolutely. Well, first, let me thank you for your far too kind comments about me. I don't deserve all that, but you're very sweet. And you're absolutely right. We have core values, and we have we do share some views. Our Venn diagram does come together, but on the things that we do differ on, I think they are increasingly far and fewer between. But we agree to disagree. And like I think it was Justice Kennedy in an interview, and he has said it in other forums, that, you know, once you talk to your opponent, you learn things that you didn't know before. And you not only learn where they're coming from, but you learn about his position, his or her position, and how those two can coalesce and come together and form a solution. So I'm happy that we have this forum, and I hope that it continues to serve the, I think, wonderful example that you sought to give by having one Republican, one Democrat, or me, now an independent. You know, show people that it does work, and it is enjoyable and enlightening and edifying. So thank you so much, and it's an honor and a privilege to be here, Mike. Really.
Well, thanks. And you know, I think it gets down to respect. You know, if you respect, I have respect for you as my friend, someone I've known for years. So if you say something that I disagree with, I don't put any kind of normative, you know, I don't say that Marilee is a bad person, you know, because I don't believe that. I believe you're a good person. And so when I look at, if you have a difference of opinion with me, what I say is you have a difference of opinion with me, you know, not that, again, back to the whole labels thing. I think we're so into that now that you're a conservative, so I know everything about you. You're a liberal, so I know everything about you. Mm-hmm. You know, and it's just crazy. The one thing that I didn't get to ask Senator Lieberman, which I would have loved to ask him, is what about our friend Joe Manchin? Nobody knows what he is these days, you know, and it's funny that he was the first guest on the No Labels radio broadcast when it went on the air in 2015. He and I can't remember who the other one was. I think it was Tom Ridge was a Republican or something, but he was a Democrat that was seen as the, you know, the No Labels guy, the good example of what it means to be less partisan, and he just turned out to be an obstructionist, and I don't even know that it's partisan obstruction. You know, I'm not sure that he's not just as interested in obstructing the Republicans as he is the Democrats. But
I absolutely agree with that. And I was going to mention that I think a lot of this nowadays is partisanship, but it's not so much partisanship, as you mentioned with Manchin's case, in that as it is just wanting to be right for whatever selfish reason it is. And I think getting reelected has become increasingly the sine qua non of a politician's existence. Of course, it's obvious that you have to get elected to be a politician, but I mean, there are other things these people can do. There are other jobs in this world. I mean, these people are, a lot of them are lawyers. Why don't they go practice? Why don't they go be a general counsel or a public advocate or a public defender? I mean, there are so many things these people can do. Why is winning the be all and end all? At the cost of whatever value you happen to hold. And I think that is a big part of this this quote unquote partisanship, this Manchin, to name him as a current example, hold on, and this infinitesimal grip on whatever position he's taking at the expense of not only his moral values, but at the expense of our country's welfare.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, that's a great point. And one of the things that I admired about Senator Lieberman is I think that he got the single most important thing about being a politician, and that is it's a service job, right? It's a job where you're supposed to serve. It's not about power. It's not it shouldn't be about power or money or prestige. It should be about service. And you know, I think some still get that, but I think a lot of them don't. It's just turned into a nonstop contest to see who can win. And you know that in the end, I think we all lose with that perspective, because I think the best thing you could do to straighten out Congress would be make congressional terms 4 years instead of 2 years. So these guys they're not always out there raising money and trying to be popular.
That's the other thing. Yes. It takes so much more money.
Yeah.
But you're right. They spend a lot of time on the phone or going to fundraise.
$800 million.
For 2 years. Yes.
$800 million they spent on the elections in Georgia. It's just amazed me. $800 million the two sides spent. When I worked for Jimmy Carter, we didn't spend that much on the presidential election. I think we spent $100 million on the presidential election, and we thought that was an incredible amount of money. And you know, now they spend over $1 billion. Obama spent over $1 billion. I'm sure Biden spent over $1 billion. Mm-hmm. But yeah. And I think also, like Lieberman pointed out and you suggested too, I think the best news and the worst news about democracy are the same news, that it represents the people. And to a certain extent, this is who we are these days, right? Who we are. We're so ready to fight over every little thing, and nobody's talking about the values that bring us together. You know, absolutely. I got a lot of positive feedback on what I wrote on Veterans Day in support of veterans.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think America appreciates, whether you believe them, I hope there's never another war. I think the most patriotic thing you can do is to protect veterans, keep them home.
Absolutely right.
And but, you know, I think we all have respect for what they've done for all of us. And, you know, and our kids and our you know, our families. I know that you have a great family. And that you're very involved with them. And you know, these things, we need to bring people together around these things, I think. We'll see.
Totally agree.
The pandemic is just, that's another thing I wanted to ask him. We didn't have a chance to ask him. He was co-chair of the bipartisan biodefense committee of Congress.
With Tom Ridge.
With Tom Ridge, exactly. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering, does this give like radicals the idea that, hey, this is a philosophy that, you know, this is a strategy that really works, man. We can bring an industrial country to its knees with this. Just like 9/11, right? They couldn't attack us, but they could fly planes into our buildings, right? And so I'm just hoping that that this doesn't inspire other terrorists to, you know, use bioweaponry, because that's really.
Well, I think it would. I think it has. But I think also they have other sort of equally nefarious and invisible, if you will, weapons, because viruses are invisible. But so is cyber warfare. That's kind of invisible.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Right? And it's already happened. I mean, they can attack our electric grids as easily as they can let loose some virus.
Well, and they can put a virus into the grid. And let me just say to terrorists out there, you don't need to bother with me, because I'm so inept at using the internet already that I'm the best thing you can do if you want to screw me up is just leave me alone. Yeah. So,
to left to your own destructive devices.
Yeah, exactly. When my kids aren't around to help me, you know, they get so annoyed with me. I'll try to look up something on my phone and they'll just grab it from me. They'll go, "Dad, give me the phone." you know, like, you know, you're an
old. I think they all do that, though.
So, but, you know, I don't know where we go from here as a country to reach out to each other, but I hope our little radio show helps do that a little bit. We've had Republicans on the show. We've had, you know, the head of the Republican Party, Michael Steele, who was the lieutenant governor of Maryland. We've had him on the show. We've had people from the Cato Institute who are Republicans on the show. We've had other Republicans on the show. We had the only Republican to ever vote for statehood on the show. He's in his 80s and he's still in Maryland working to clean up rivers that flow into the Chesapeake Bay. He's, you know, an amazing guy. And, you know, but we want to have more of that on the show because we want people to feel that there's a place that they can come to, a place that they can ask questions, a place that they can listen to ideas which, you know, affect all of us, you know. And again, I'm just so happy to have you on the show, you know.
Well, so thank you, Mike. I'm so thrilled to be here. And, you know, along the lines of what you just said, I have a science head. I mean, I've worked in politics and science, as you know, and in journalism. And my science head sticks. And in thinking about this, you're mentioning the Maryland guy, and I forget who we were just talking about as well, but Michael Steele, people whose core values allows them to be open and share ideas and be open to others' ideas and take others' ideas, analyze it and say, okay, I agree with that or I don't agree with that, or how can we work that out mutually satisfactory fashion? And I'm one of those in terms of issues, as you know. So what about this collective group of people, to approach it sort of from a semi-scientific way, what about this group of people that allows them to do that? What is the common denominator? What is the vein that runs through this group of people? And perhaps something can come out of that. You know, maybe those types of people, all those people can form a group.
Yeah. You know, well, you know, that's one of the reasons that I wanted you so much on the show, is because of that background. Because as you may or may not know, I cried in front of the professor to get a C in biology 101.
You know,
I took my first lab practical and I looked through the first 10 microscopes and in every one I saw paramecium. And then I got to the end and I said, what are the chances that they made everyone one of them has to be something else. But so it's great to have somebody with a scientific background. And you know what? We do think of things differently, right? And
yes,
and that's the whole idea of all of this, is that I think, you know, one of the most important things, if I had to leave like three or four pieces of advice to my children, one of them would be Einstein. What you see depends on where you stand. You know, what the way something looks is absolutely relative to where you are in the world. And you know, we have so much in a country that's made up of so many different cultures.
Oh my gosh.
So many different backgrounds. Yeah, we have so much. And I think that's one of the reasons we've been so successful, you know, that
amazingly so, because it is not so homogeneous. It is extremely heterogeneous, yeah. Not just in people, but in land,
yeah,
in topography and geography. So it's incredible, you know. And as I traveled to Wyoming and looking down, swaths of no land, not one house down there, not one sign of civilization. It's just amazing that this country, as large as it is and as heterogeneous as it is, has done so well. It's something to be really proud of.
You know, last time I was in Wyoming, I think was 1972.
Oh
And I remember going down a highway and thinking to myself, I was by myself, if I run out of gas or something happened, I could die Yeah, I could die here, and people would not, you know, it'd be a month before anybody figured it out. You know, coming from this area where I grew up, you and I grew up not far from each other. But
that's right.
But going out there and driving down a highway for 20 minutes and not having anybody pass you the other way was like something out of the Twilight Zone. I don't think we get it. That people in Manhattan are never going to think the way the people in Wyoming think, or people in California. I remember going out on the beach. You'll love this. I get to San Diego. I went on this trip where I went through every state I'd never been in when I was 18, 19. And so I get to California. No, I should have got on my motorcycle because then I'd still be in Maryland. I had a motorcycle that broke down like every 10 miles. I think I had an old Harley Davidson. I think I pushed it more than I rode it.
I remember.
But I got out to California and I walked out onto the beach in my loafers and black socks and shorts and t-shirt. And I saw all these blonde guys with perfect bodies and surfboards and bare feet. And I said to myself, this is not a place for a kid from New Jersey, you know, like, where's the boardwalk? I don't get it. There's people swimming in the water. What the hell is that? You know,
it's blue.
Yeah, you actually can see through it. That can't be right. You know, so we all come from different perspectives, but we're running out of time here. So let me just say to my good friend, Marilia Duffels, I'm so happy to have you on the show and to have your amazing perspective. And for the sake of transparency, let me say that Marilia and I bonded in a way that I think people bond a lot. We had a job where we were both systematically abused by our employer. So we got to. Yeah, so we bound together in for our survival, I think, in that environment. And you make good friends that way, friends of
a
life.
We sure did. And with Pam Wazalewski as well.
Pam Wazalewski.
Part of the trio that kept each other afloat.
And let's just say, let's give her a shout out because she's a new grandma.
Yeah.
I've seen many pictures of her lovely grandson. It's funny when you have your first child, right? You take 10,000 pictures. And then when we had the third child, we've got like two pictures of Mary. Joy complains about it. She goes, I'm not a member of the family. And that was my brother. When he became a grandfather, I finally had to write him and say, as beautiful as your grandson is, he really doesn't look that much different at 3 weeks old as he did at 2 weeks old. You know, so like send him a picture and he went out for his first birthday or something. But it's great. Well, thanks to our listeners. Thanks to Marilia for once again helping me out here. I'm sorry that I monopolized so much in the Senator's time. But as we go on, I think you'll see that we have a different perspective and it's an important perspective. And we're going to leave you with a song we always do. I always do this at the end of the show, dedicated to our guests. And this goes out to Senator Lieberman and all the people that are involved in No Labels, which is a great cause. Here's Dave Mason.
Amen.
With We Just Disagree, because it's the truth. You know, there are no good guys. There are no bad guys. There's just you and me, and we just disagree. Thanks.
That's lovely, Mike.
All right.